More likely than not, if you're over 65, your internist has declared everything between your belly button and your thighs to be the no-need zone. No need for a pap, no need for a speculum, no need to remove your underpants, and definitely no need to see a gynecologist. This stems from a 2014 recommendation from the American College of Physicians, a group that represents internists, not gynecologists, stating that non-pregnant women who do not have specific complaints need not have a gynecologic exam. Add to that the 2012 recommendation that low-risk women over 65 need not have a pap test. This led to a great deal of celebration on the part of women over the age of 65 who were ecstatic to delete annual gynae exam from their to-do list. Most internists were equally happy to have a garage sale for their speculums and not have to deal with down there problems. But in today's episode, I'm joined by Dr. Shieva Gofraini to explain the flaw in this reasoning and why no complaint is not the same as no problem, and why even if you've had a hysterectomy, you're not off the hook. You may not have a uterus, but you still have a vagina, vulva, and possibly your ovaries, and repercussions of menopause that are beyond what your internist is capable or willing to address. I'm Dr. Lauren Stryker, a gynecologist, best-selling author, and a nationally recognized menopause expert. When it comes to menopause, midlife, and what comes after, I'm betting you've not gotten a lot of information from your own doctor. If women are given good information, they'll make good choices, and I'm here to give you the inside information. Before I bring on Dr. Gofraini, I want to respond to the specific behind the statement from the American College of Physicians, again, the group that represents internists, not gynecologists, that non-pregnant women who do not have a specific complaint need not have a gynecologic exam. So let me start with the no complaint part. Studies have shown that the majority of women who have conditions such as urinary incontinence, fecal incontinence, vaginal odor, vaginal dryness, unusual discharge, and vulvar discomfort don't mention it to their doctor, either out of embarrassment or thinking that losing urine, painful sex, are a normal part of aging. Studies also show that the majority of doctors don't ask if these symptoms exist. So more often than not, these conditions go untreated. So much for no complaint. And then the second part of it is that so many of these conditions don't even have symptoms. Women with growing fibroids, pelvic infections that can lead to infertility, ovarian cysts, so many other pelvic conditions have no symptoms, but early diagnosis can make a big difference when it comes to avoiding problems down the road. Dr. Gofraini and I are going to definitely be talking about that. But, you know, just a few years ago, I saw a 55-year-old woman who hadn't seen her gynecologist in many, many years. Her internist told her she had a hysterectomy, pelvic exam wasn't necessary. And since she had no complaints, her doctor never put a speculum in or looked in her vagina. Evidently, though, she did have a complaint, a bloody vaginal discharge. She finally made her way to me, and a 15-second speculum exam detected what turned out to be a stage 4 vaginal cancer. These things don't turn up overnight, and a vaginal exam long before it became symptomatic would have detected her problem when it was early and treatable. The obvious question, of course, is, okay, so what's the harm in performing an annual speculum and bimanual exam? Well, according to the American College of Physicians, pelvic exams are embarrassing. What? I mean, for whom? If the doctor's embarrassed, well, the patient's going to be embarrassed. Not to mention rectal exams are embarrassing, testicular exams are embarrassing. Should those be admitted as well? This propagates and validates that many women's health concerns are taboo topics. Don't talk about your vaginal odor. Don't talk about your sexual concerns. Don't talk about your incontinence. Not even to your doctor. If every other body part is examined but the genitals, it sends a clear message that the pelvis, vagina, and vulva are not part of the regular comprehensive physical. The pelvic exam should be normalized, not marginalized. And then they go on to say that the exam shouldn't be performed because it's painful. And in fact, the American College of Physicians reported that up to 60% of women said the exam was painful. 60%. One has to wonder why the majority of the patients in their study experienced pain. Was the person inserting the speculum inexperienced? Did he or she use a jumbo speculum? Maybe some exams were painful because the woman had terrible vaginal dryness that she forgot to complain about. A pelvic exam should never be painful. And if it is, that in and of itself may indicate a problem. They also stated that a pelvic exam simply takes too much time. Okay. I mean, we're talking a minute. about the same amount of time it takes to listening to a heart, which in most cases is completely worthless. And I'm guessing my patient with vaginal cancer would have been glad to put up with 1 minute of embarrassment instead of undergoing cancer treatments and fighting for her life. The American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists continue to recommend an annual pelvic exam, even in a non-PAP test year. And again, to be fair, many internists and family practitioners are totally comfortable doing a pelvic exam and are eager to address many of the issues I described above. The real message from my point of view, there is value in an annual exam, but it depends on who does it. So take your pelvis to a doctor or an advanced practice nurse who's interested, competent, and not embarrassed. And now I want to welcome Dr. Gofrani for a discussion of why you should not be crossing annual gynecologic exam off your to-do list. Welcome. Welcome, Dr. Gofrani.
Hi, how are you? I love seeing you, Dr. Stryker, as always.
So big topic. You and I have already chatted about a lot of this stuff and we can go on forever, but we're going to try and focus.
Yes. I mean, last night, ironically, I gave a talk to our Georgetown Alumni Association, and this was one of the things I brought up with them. You still need to see your gynecologist. So you and I can delineate all the reasons why.
I mean, this is a thing with us. And that's why I thought you'd be the perfect person to discuss this because yes, you're a menopause expert. Yes, you're a sexual medicine expert, but you're also one of those people that you are still a general gynecologist. I mean, you even deliver babies for God's sakes, but I mean, you know, I know.
Yeah. And listen, for a full disclosure, I would never say I'm a sexual health expert or even a menopause expert in that the field is changing so much, but I'm a general OBGYN and we really are so necessary for women. You need a good primary care doctor. You need a good gynecologist. Till the day you die.
Yeah, until the day you die. Exactly. Yes. A lot of this actually started with not only the internist saying that nothing is needed after a certain age unless you have a problem, but also the whole PAP test thing. I mean, that was in 2018 when the U.S. Preventative Task Force came out with this recommendation that PAP tests were just not necessary for low-risk women over age 65. And here we are 6 years later. And I'm sure you saw the study that came out last year that showed an alarming rate of older women not just having cervical cancer, but dying from cervical cancer because it was detected at a later stage when it was less treatable.
And in fact, I think 20 to
30%. Exactly. Yeah. 20% of cervical cancers occur in women over the age of 65. So let's start with this. What do you tell your patients about PAP tests?
Okay, so first of all, and this is not just for women over 65 and people with vulvas and cervixes over 65. This is for all women. Just like I said yesterday to the women who ranged from 30 to 70, even if you hear the Pap smear guidelines, which we'll review quickly, it doesn't mean you don't go see your gynecologist. We are much more than just a Pap. So the guidelines now in the last several years have said that you only need a Pap smear every 1 to 5 years. Based on a variety of things like your age, your past history, your past Pap smear. And so it's not an easy algorithm. It's not like women say to me, I've heard you only need it every 5 years. You and I know that's not true, meaning you might qualify for every 5 years based on, again, your age, your past Pap smear history, your most recent Pap smear history, other risk factors, but you might need it every year. And each year, the number will change with which you have to come back, because it's based on the current Pap smear results, because we're looking at it from a risk perspective. So knowing that confuses people because they think, oh, well, the doctor said I don't need a Pap for 5 years. I don't need to go back. And the answer is no, you should still see your gynecologist every year.
Right. And we're going to talk about that a little bit, even if it's not a Pap test year.
Much more than not a Pap year. Exactly.
Right. But just as far as the Pap test itself, I mean, you say women are confused. Doctors are confused.
Clinicians are confused.
Everybody's confused.
Yes. And actually, this is something good for everyone to know. I was just at ACOG last week, the American College of OBGYN, our national conference that you and I know about. One of the very big people in ASCCP, which is our guidelines for the Pap smears, he even said that while the guidelines say you can stop a Pap smear after age 65, he really thinks and hopes that those guidelines are going to change. And he's one of the people who is actually creating a lot of these guidelines.
Well, and to that point, I had interviewed, actually during the first season, I have to go back and take a listen to it, but Melissa Simon, who's a physician, was part of the U.S. Preventative Task Force Committee. And I asked her if this recommendation was a huge mistake and that this has really backfired. And she agreed that we really need to change this a little bit. But But I think part of the confusion is when you look at the specific guideline, it does stipulate for low-risk women. And the intention was never that all women would just skip their Pap test after 65. It was low-risk women. But somehow that memo didn't get out to the world.
Well,
And
but also,
so how do you define low risk? I
how do
think,
you define low risk?
I mean, who's low risk? Well, a virgin who is 65 is
Right.
probably low risk. Maybe someone who's had the exact same partner for their entire life is low risk.
If they can guarantee it, right?
But who knows? Who
Who
knows? So,
knows?
the reality is that clearly from that study last year, we are missing a lot of women that are perceived as being low risk, but they're not. The other thing also is that you and I know that from the time of exposure to HPV, human papillomavirus, which is what causes cervical cancer, until the time that someone has cervical cancer is what, 20, 25 years?
Yeah. I mean, at the very least, we say it 10 years, right? So,
So you can have someone who gets exposed when they're 45 or 50 and they've had nothing but normal Pap tests. And then lo and behold, they're 67 and have cervical cancer. And because no one's looking and no one's doing a Pap test, it gets missed.
right.
Okay, so I think that we are in agreement that a
Yes.
Pap test is not something that people should scratch off their to-do list, despite the recommendation. But
Yes.
let's talk about the value of having a gynecologic exam, even if it's a no Pap year. Meaning, if someone says, okay, I get my Pap test every 3 years, does that mean I only have to have a gynecologic exam every 3 years?
Well, the answer is no, you should have a gynecological exam every year. And I say for two reasons. One is very concrete, and one is a little bit more like high level, nebulous, but still valuable. The concrete, you still need a breast exam. You need a visual inspection of the external vulva. Probably you need a speculum exam of the internal vagina. That could be debated, I think, as to whether or not there's a lot of value in the absence of symptoms inside your vagina. We still do a pelvic exam where you and I put our hand into the vagina and feel outside the pelvis to make sure there's no masses. Again, there is debate as to whether or not that particular part of the exam is very sensitive at picking up masses. But the concrete answer is you need all those physical exams in addition to discussion about your bone health, your brain health, your colon health, reminder of some of the screening tests you need to do that, yes, your internist can take care of, but they don't talk about all of them.
Okay, I'm going to interrupt you there because I want to talk a little bit about the woman who says, my internist said, I don't need to see a gynecologist because they're going to do the Pap test. People can't see your face because this is a podcast, but your face kind of looked like my face. And let's just give the caveat before we go down this road that there are internists who are exceptions. There are internists, and you and I can both see them,
Absolutely.
who are outstanding when it comes to women's health and who do a complete and thorough gynecologic exam, including a vulvar exam, a vaginal exam, a bimanual pelvic exam, like you're talking about. But then we get to the internist who says, don't worry, Mrs. Fofofnik, I'm just going to do the Pap test. And they put the speculum in, they do the swab, 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 and they say, okay, you're all set. What would be your response to that?
Well, and that actually leads in well to the second reason I was saying, which is a little bit more like high level lofty, which is then there's no educational aspect to this. So they're doing the Pap smear. If it comes back normal, then they might say, oh, you don't need it for 5 years, but without any instruction. For example, if you remain low risk, you don't have a new partner, you don't suspect your partner has had other partners, you don't notice any symptoms. They also don't actually know how to handle, and it's not their fault. Just like I don't want to take care of someone's cholesterol. I understand the basics, but I don't want to be in charge of cholesterol. I want a primary care physician or a cardiologist to do it. They don't know how to handle the follow-up of the Pap smear. So the higher level here is when you have an abnormal Pap smear, it invokes a huge amount of anxiety. And what we see a lot is the primary care did the Pap smear, came back irregular. Now the patient's level of anxiety is tenfold of what it would have been had we done it, because the ideal for us as gynecologists is that we're also educating during this.
That's
We're
right.
taking the time during the exam to not only create a relationship with this person so that in the future, if they need us, they know that they can come in and trust us, but we're educating them on their breast exam, what to look for, on certain symptoms during their vulva, about their vulva, what might happen if they have an abnormal Pap smear. So again, You and I want a relationship so that long-term women can feel safe and that they have a place to go to. And no one doctor could do it. We can't do it for all the primary care, and they can't do it.
But just to be like very clear about the problem with the internist just doing the Pap test is, first of all, a lot of women have this idea that a Pap test screens for everything, that it's going to screen
Absolutely.
For, you know, my Pap test was fine, so I don't need
therefore,
to worry
I don't have
about
anything.
Vulvar cancer, vaginal cancer, you know, uterine cancer, ovarian cancer.
Ovarian cancer.
Too many people think that a Pap test tests for everything. And like you said, the internist is not educating. So that's number one. And the number two is, to your point, when you say that if there's an abnormal Pap test, and this poor woman is now gets the call from the internist or the primary care saying, your Pap test was abnormal, you need to see a gynecologist. And then it takes her a month or two to get in. And anxiety is
maybe more because
maybe
she
more.
Hasn't established
and then,
a relationship,
especially with an abnormal, because it's not, you know, just a regular exam. And then, of course, she's already consulting Dr. Google, who tells her she has 10 minutes to live.
Mm-hmm.
When in fact, one of the most common abnormalities that we see in postmenopause women is atypical cells
mm-hmm.
with no HPV changes, which more often than not is because of dryness, and you give her a little vaginal estrogen and you repeat the Pap test 2 months later and it's completely normal.
Mm-hmm.
Internists don't know that. And that's just one example as to your point that you have to have someone who can not only do the test, but who could interpret the test. The other problem with women who are not seeing a gynecologist is that, let's face it, a gynecologist is really good at doing these exams. And in women who are already having vaginal dryness, shrinkage of the tissue, discomfort, and pain, they need someone who not only has expertise and experience, but multiple sizes of speculums.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, in your office and in my office, I can't even count the different sizes of speculums that we have in terms of
mm-hmm.
the length, the width, how far it opens. It just, the variety is just as many as the variety in vaginas, right?
Mm-hmm.
But if you go to an internist or a family practice doctor in general, they have one or maybe two sizes, and
right.
one size does not fit all.
Right.
Or even worse, they have those disposable plastic
speculums with
that
a
are
click, click,
truly,
click.
Yeah.
Oh, no, I can't see.
You know, one
yeah.
size fits no one. So I'm just throwing
yeah.
that out there as well for women who say, I don't want anyone doing that exam because it just hurts so much
mm-hmm.
that, are you kidding? I don't want to go to the gynecologist. And I will tell you that a gynecologist who not only has expertise, but a variety of sizes in terms of the speculum. And as a last thing, you don't always need a speculum exam. You know,
right.
Sometimes I will have a woman who comes in who maybe has vulvar issues or needs to have that exam just in terms of her pelvic organs, but don't not necessarily have
right.
the speculum. So,
right.
okay.
Yeah.
Well, before they put the speculum in, did they take a close look at your vulva?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you need to look.
Mm-hmm.
And can we just talk about a few of the vulvar problems that
yeah.
that women have that they may not be aware of, that they may
I
not
mean,
even have symptoms for? But I mean, if someone's not looking at your vulva, and let's just face it, most women are not looking at their own vulvas. Even if they
right.
have a partner who's looking at their vulva, it's generally in the dark and they don't know what they're looking for anyway.
Right. And
so,
unless there's something
so what
different,
kinds
yeah.
of things does a clinician need to look at in terms of a routine exam specifically on the vulva?
So there are benign and malignant conditions. I'm sure that in your long career and in my long career, I know there have been times where patients have come in, for example, with pigmented lesions, and their view is like, what? Oh, I think it's always been there. Oh, I'm not sure. Maybe it's darker. Maybe it's not. I don't even know it was there. I didn't look. So women can get melanoma on their vulva. So that's
Uh-huh.
important to look at. They can have benign lumps and bumps, like sebaceous cysts that might really bother them, but they didn't know that they could do anything about it, where they have that collection of sebum that we can remove. They can have much more detrimental issues like lichen sclerosis, which is the entity where their vulva gets whiter and blanched, and it leads to potentially a lot of itching, but not always itching. And that can be a precursor for vulvar cancer.
Well, that's, I want to stop you there because I want to spend a minute talking about lichen sclerosis. I think I have a podcast called Nothing to Like about lichen sclerosis. Maybe that was just a blog that I wrote. But lichen sclerosis is a very, very common dermatologic condition. Oh, it can appear at any age, but it is certainly more common in women over the age of 50. And while some women are clearly symptomatic, you know, itching and burning, and they literally are bleeding from the constant scratching, there are also women that have no symptoms, or even more common that they've been misdiagnosed because they're 50 or 60 and they say to their, you know, who's ever taking care of them, I have dryness or itching. And they go, oh, well, here's some estrogen cream without looking, when in fact it's lichen sclerosis. And as you mentioned, aside from being unpleasant, lichen sclerosis, if untreated, and that's the important part, if untreated, can be a precursor to vulvar cancer, which is the fourth most common gynecologic malignancy in the United States, causing about 1,000 deaths a year, and is almost exclusively in women who are post-menopause who are not getting an exam. And if you find it when it's at the lichen sclerosis stage, it's 100% treatable.
Right, we can fix it.
A topical cream with a steroid cream, you know?
And it can really, lichen sclerosis can cause their vulva to close up. The opening, the introitus, the opening to the vagina can get really small, which makes sex even more painful if people even want to be having sex, or impossible. And on top of it, I mean, again, you and I have both experienced this. I can't say the number of times with my patients who talk really openly to me in general, but still, they say there's no complaints. I go to look at their vulva, and I say, were you going to tell me that you've been chronically itching this area? And often their response is, oh, can you tell? And the answer is yes. We're gynecologists. We're looking. We see these changes. We see that the tissue either looks thicker, it looks more blanched, it looks irritated. And that's not always lichen sclerosis. We know that it sometimes is just that chronic itch scratch cycle. There can be other things that are occurring there. But you should tell your doctor about that because we can help you. First and foremost, we need to make sure it's not something that is concerning, like lichen sclerosis or malignancy. Assuming it's not, and sometimes that's visual, sometimes that's a vulvar biopsy, but assuming it's none of those things, you deserve treatment. And not every itch is a yeast infection. I think so many women of every age are also misdiagnosed because they just call the office, and in an effort to save them a visit, the doctor's, you know, assistants will say, oh, it's probably a yeast infection. Let me call something in. The patient assumes that's what it is. She might get temporary relief, and then a week or two later, it comes back. And then they might assume it's a bacterial infection. So a lot of this is often triaged either just over-the-counter medications or on the phone, and no one is ever looking.
Right.
So,
Well, and I would always say that when they say the yeast medication didn't work, and I say, no, it worked just fine if there was any yeast there. But you
Wrong
thing. You needed to treat something else.
Well, what I always laugh when people say to me, I have a yeast infection, I always say, okay, great. So how about instead of telling me what you have, tell me your symptoms so that I can help decide what I think you have, because it's not always yeast.
Well, and where that comes from, of course, is before they've consulted you, they've consulted Dr. Google. And one of my favorite studies was in an emergency room where when people entered the emergency room, they said to them, before you came in, did you look for your symptoms online? And 100% of them said yes. And based on your online search, what is your diagnosis? And they would say the diagnosis. And then on the way out, they did the post-interview when they found that I think it was some number like 90% of them had something other than what Dr. Google told them they had.
Oh,
but most important is that the thing that Dr. Google told them they had was far more catastrophic than what they did have. You know, the headache was definitely a brain tumor.
And they were going to die.
Definitely ovarian cancer and all of that. So, so that's the danger in that. But just to put a period on the end of the lichen sclerosis thing, the other thing I want to mention is that when you think, okay, but if they're putting a speculum in, they're going to see if there's something there right there. And the response to that is a lot of times lichen sclerosis is limited to the area around the clitoris or the hood over the clitoris. And if they're not looking there specifically, they're not going to see it. You know, when someone puts that speculum in, they're not looking up north. They're just looking right in the opening of the vagina where they're placing the speculum, and they will miss it. symptoms of genital urinary syndrome of menopause and all those recurrent urinary tract infections and urgency. You know, that's all part of the exam.
And also, it's, listen, this is what I always think of. When most people have a car, if they're being really diligent with their car, they take their car in at least twice a year for an entire tune-up and look at all of the systems. Don't women's bodies deserve the same thing? So I look at it as, if I'm an internist, I don't want to take care of every single organ system. And if I'm a gynecologist, I don't want to take care of every single organ system. So the ideal would be twice a year. Once a year, you see your primary care. Once a year, you see your gynecologist. And we really can synergistically have some overlap. Hopefully, we're both talking about bones, for example, and breast and colon. But let's let them mostly take care of the cardiovascular system and certain other
Absolutely.
Systems. Let's let us mostly take care of the stuff that we know, again, with overlap and education. Because the truth is, until we get to that point, then women don't have good relationships with either of these doctors. And they are looking at it from the point of view of, I'll just go when I need to. But then you can't get in to see these doctors when you need to.
Right.
You don't necessarily see the people you want to see. You don't see the people who are going to actually provide good education for you. And that really, someone asked me yesterday, what is the most important issue for women today? And I was like, oh God, there's so many. But one pervasive issue is lack of OBGYN health knowledge, which leads to increased avoidance and anxiety. And doctor, we ourselves, you and I, love taking care of our patients and love talking a lot. We don't even have the time with every single patient to educate on every single entity.
Right. Funny coincidence. You were talking about this yesterday. I was on a panel last night mm-hmm. about midlife women with a very large group. And I was asking the exact same question. You know, mm-hmm. what are we missing? What is important? What needs to happen? And like you, I said, well, I could give, you know, 3 hours worth of answer on this mm-hmm. one. But what I did say is I think the big issue that's missing is even if you have a clinician who is addressing the symptoms, the hot flashes, the vaginal dryness, and in offering solutions, the bigger picture is no one is addressing what are the long-term consequences of estrogen deprivation in mm-hmm. terms of cognitive function, in terms of cardiovascular health, in terms mm-hmm. of vulvar and vaginal health, even if you are getting what you and I would consider to be pretty good midlife care. Okay, so let's go back. We have a woman who doesn't need a pap test. She is wondering why she needs to see mm-hmm. a gynecologist. So first, let's talk about gynecologic conditions that women might have symptoms, but she has been told, don't worry about it. That's just a normal part of aging.
If she's even been told, because many things you and I know we'll talk about, you're never told anything because you as the woman either don't think that you can bring it up because you either have systematically been sent the message that that's just normal, don't even bring it up, or you're embarrassed. So I think the most pervasive one that you and I know, well, there's several pervasive, but incontinence. Urinary incontinence is something, I mean, I can't tell you how many times, and I know you experience this as well, I'll be doing an exam on a woman and I'll say, oh, any issues? We'll talk about it beforehand. I'll also talk about it during, like while I'm looking at their vulva. Any issues down here? Is anything bothering you? No, I mean, no, it's all fine. Really? Meaning you're not having any issues? Like, is it painful you have sex? You might not even feel like having sex. Are you having any itching? Are you losing any urine? Are you having incontinence? Once you ask them and elicit it, and there's data to support this, so many women will say, well, yeah, I mean, I do lose my pee when I cough and laugh and sneeze, but I thought that was just normal.
Right.
And let us be very clear here. It is a very common side effect of pregnancy and childbirth, particularly vaginal birth. And it's a very common thing that happens to women as we lack estrogen, but that doesn't mean it's normal. I always distinguish normal is what should happen. Common is what does happen. And if someone wants to live with their incontinence, they have that right. But most women, if you ask them and you offered them some help, they would say, oh my gosh, I didn't even know that that was available to me. I didn't even think to ask, or I was embarrassed.
A lot of times when I have that exact same discussion and the response is, well, I don't want to have surgery, because they think that the only treatment of involuntary loss of urine is surgery. And when I point out to them that, yes, sometimes people have surgery for that, but most women don't require surgery, that mm-hmm. we have pelvic floor physical therapy. We have so many other things that we can offer. And while we're on the topic of taboo topics, there are women that have stool incontinence and mm-hmm. they are mortified and they do not bring it up. And again, you know, yet another example of mm-hmm. the kind of thing that women do have concerns about, but don't bring up because they don't think that there are safe or effective solutions. Right. And you mentioned sexual issues, which is the other big one. How many women are asked, do you have any issues or concerns? And they say no. And then when you specifically say, do you have sexual concerns like pain with sexual activity or an inability to have an orgasm, then they'll say, well, yeah, but I just thought that that was normal. Aging.
Or lack of desire. If they knew that a very common part of aging is waning libido, especially when you're in a long-term relationship, they would be able to talk about it more. If they knew that a common side effect of going through menopause, especially after childbirth, was incontinence, they would be able to talk about it. And they would know that there are a variety of ways to address it. And so they would have access to that. And so again, to me, the biggest problem is knowledge, because we just don't have
knowledge. And while we're on the topic of not getting the information they need, when we talk about any menopause symptoms, whether it's hot flashes or, of course, vaginal dryness, even non-sexually, the brain fog, all of that, it's going to be dismissed, or you're going to be told this is just a normal part of aging, tough it out, and it will go away.
So a lot of times patients will say, well, I am having hot flashes, night sweats, mood changes, whatever. The doctor or nurse practitioner or PA will respond with, well, is it that bad? And I think immediately when you say something like that, I understand the intention. The intention is, do you want me to really address it with you and figure out how to help it? But then most patients are going to say, well, I mean, I guess it's not that bad, but what is that bad? It's such a spectrum, and it's so completely subjective that every person deserves to be able to say it's that bad because it's bothering me.
And what we did to address that in the Center for Sexual Medicine and Menopause is basically I listed every single symptom I could think of. And then they would check off a box that says, I have this symptom, but it doesn't bother me. It bothers me a little. It bothers me a lot. And then, of course, the final box, which is the most important, this is something I would like to address. And it was surprising to me, things that people said, yeah, I have this and this and this and that, but I don't really care about it. It doesn't bother me.
And it also has to do with like time equity, right? Nowadays, you get 15, max 30 minutes if you're going to be with your patient. So let's say you're an internist and you have to take care of them head to toe and you're doing them a service by doing the pap smear. I would say it's virtually impossible, even with a really intentional primary care doctor, to be so intentional about an entire vulvar and vaginal exam, which you and I can do pretty quickly because we're used to doing it and visually look very quickly and put in the speculum, kind of do it all at once within a shorter period of time. It's harder for them to do it. And it's not their fault. But then I think they should just recognize as primary care doctors where they should relinquish control. And by the way, I think you and I should both also say this. This is not to drum up business for the gynecologist. We have more than enough patients. Most of us don't have time to see the current patient load.
Exactly. That's why you can't get in.
Not for that. Yeah. Right. It's not for that. But it is also very much so that you develop a relationship with your gynecologist. Let's assume we could guarantee every single thing you and I talked about isn't going to be there. There's no incontinence. There's no lichen sclerosis. There's nothing. You are still a person with organs that may cause something in your future. And once you have that bloating, that pelvic pain, that pelvic pressure, that irregular postmenopausal bleeding, you want to have had a relationship with a doctor or a nurse practitioner or PA so that you can get in to see them in a timely manner. It is just a matter of logistics. Trying to scramble to find a doctor when you're having symptoms is the worst time.
Let's go back to the issue of the woman who now has developed a significant problem and has no relationship.
Right.
So
that's the problem.
And let me circle back, because I am going to put in the program notes the last episode that we did together, which was a long time ago. I think it was during my first season. But just as a reminder for those of you who did not listen to that episode, I will mention that Dr. Gofraini is not only an amazing gynecologist and an expert in all this, but has a personal history with this as well. So just talk about that a little bit, because I think that's relevant to this discussion.
Well, despite being a gynecologist, you and I are not immune to gynecological issues. In fact, I joke, I have like the what's what list of gynecological and obstetric issues myself, between pregnancy loss and a bunch of other things, including ovarian cancer when I was 46. I was lucky and privileged enough to be a doctor, so I knew the signs and symptoms. And so mine was found at stage two, because I knew that if I had bloating and pain and pressure, which I had all of, that I needed a pelvic ultrasound. And the pelvic ultrasound in my own office led to me to have an MRI, which led to me to have surgery for what was perceived to be some irregular endometriosis in my ovary that could be ovarian cancer. You and I know that it's rare for endometriosis to transform into ovarian cancer, but it does sometimes. But had I been a patient without a physician, then it would have been harder for me to get in. It would have taken longer to get the ultrasound. I wouldn't have had that relationship with the doctor. I wouldn't have then been able to get to the gynecology oncologist. And so all of these led to me, again, having stage two instead of stage three and four ovarian cancer, which is where it's typically found. And that's why I'm still here 8 years
exactly.
later.
That's why we're having this conversation.
Right? And so that is, yeah, that really, I mean, and that's why what's frustrating to me, even in the medical community, is when people are very concrete, like, well, what if they don't need a breast exam because they're already getting their mammogram? And let's say they don't need the pelvic exam because, you know, they don't have any more pelvic organs other than their vulva and their gynec and their internist is looking. But again, one internist, and I say this in defense of the internist, they have the burden of looking at so many other organ systems. Yeah. They deserve to not have to worry about these other issues. And a woman deserves to have the gynecologist. We haven't even talked about mental health that you and I discuss with our patients, just the emotional aspects of being able to lean on us for a lot of other things, but just being able to be there as the person so that if in case something comes up, because it's not a rare if. I mean, there are so many parts of our bodies that we have potential yeah. issues with in our life. You need to have someone you have that relationship with so that you can, again, you can call them, you can get in to see them, they can order the right tests, they can expedite the things you need. And yeah. so I really think it's so still completely strange to me that anyone would choose to forego the opportunity to be with a gynecologist if they can do it.
Yeah, well, absolutely. And when you look at the internal medicine recommendation, that there's no need for a pelvic exam. And one of the rationales they gave for that is that, well, you're not going to find the ovarian cancer anyway. And they are correct in that most cases, especially right. with an early ovarian cancer, not only the pelvic exam, but quite frankly, the ultrasound can be normal with an early ovarian cancer. But having said that, sometimes you do find the ovarian cancer or you find the colon cancer because the mass is in the pelvis. And if no one's doing a pelvic exam, they're not going to find it. So it's not just about finding gynecologic problems.
And it's also outside of the physical exam, which you and I know. I mean, if we're finding ovarian cancer on a physical exam, it probably has already produced symptoms that the patient mm-hmm. has probably ignored. But right. I will guarantee you that my patient population knows what signs and symptoms to look for because I say to them all the time, I'm doing a pelvic exam. This might feel normal, but promise that if in the next several months or any time in your life you have bloating or pain or pressure for more than 2 weeks, you are going to come see a gynecologist because that's the only way we're going to be able to find these things early until we come up with a screening test for ovarian cancer, which we're seemingly very far away from. So again, it's that education aspect. And this is why I keep going back to the education, which the truth is our medical system doesn't value education right now, right? It values the things
that
are concrete.
We don't get paid for educating people.
We don't get paid for educating.
We get paid for doing procedures. We get paid for doing ultrasounds, for doing diagnostic testing. But we always would say the minute we sit there and actually have a conversation with the patient, we are basically losing money.
Right. That is a crying shame because you and I both know how much money we would save for the system if the system invested just a little bit in the preemptive education for women and all of the organ systems. What are you screened for? What are you not screened for? What are the signs and symptoms you could look for so that you can have an early diagnosis? Yeah. We would save so much money, but nobody wants to invest in that. And so that's what I'm kind of advocating for is go to your gynecologist so that you can have a relationship and so that you can get some education. Now, the truth is the burden is also on us as the gynecologists to be better about educating. And many gynecologists themselves don't want to do it.
Or they don't have the expertise. You know, they don't talk about menopause. And we've gone on and on, beat that horse many times about how many gynecologists don't know anything about menopause. But the other response that you and I are going to get to this discussion is, well, that all sounds great. My insurance only covers one well woman exam a year. And if I am 55, 60, 65, should that be with an internist or should that be with a gynecologist? And I'm in the camp that your gynecologist is not your primary care doctor.
No,
I don't want to be the one to treat your high blood pressure, to screen you for cardiovascular disease. So yes, you need to see your internist, but it's a problem. And hopefully you have a plan that you can have a problem visit so that it's not an annual visit, but that you are there specifically to discuss fill in the blank, your incontinence issues, your menopause issues. You know, we can generally find some kind of diagnosis to justify the fact that you are coming in for something other than well woman care.
Well, every woman who is postmenopausal, you and I know, I think we can say with clear authority, every woman who's postmenopausal has genitourinary syndrome of menopause in some degree, whether or not they even realize it, meaning
or whether or not they're bothered by it. Yeah.
Right. Their vulva and vagina is going to become atrophic. And so that is absolutely something that every woman can say, I'm going to the gynecologist for that. But the truth is, at least where I am in Connecticut, most of the private insurances will cover an annual exam with your gynecologist and an annual exam with your primary care until Medicare after age 65. And then it's once every 2 years. But on the alternate years, most of my patients would still come in either because they wanted to and I encouraged it. And I said, we'll talk about your vulva and your vagina and any other issues you may have. So on alternate years from their well woman visit, they would have a problem visit. And if they really didn't want to come in, they at least knew that they had a relationship with me, that every 2 years they were going to see me and that they could always call and come back in for a problem. So again, we can't stress enough. You need a relationship with a gynecologist that you feel that you can talk to so that if something comes up, which it inevitably does, you can get in to see them.
Right? Okay. 1/3 of women in the United States by age 60 no longer have a uterus. Yeah. And women are told after their hysterectomy, this is this consistent message that we're getting out there, no, you don't need to see the gynecologist anymore because you've had a hysterectomy. So just to be clear, hysterectomy is removal of the uterus, which sometimes also includes removal of the cervix, but not always, which sometimes also includes removal of the tubes and the ovaries, but not always. Mm-hmm. So I think we have established very well that even if you don't have a uterus or tubes or ovaries, you still have a vulva and vagina and all these other issues, menopausal issues, et cetera, that it's worthy of an exam. But let's talk about the fact that many women who've had a hysterectomy still have ovaries.
Mm-hmm. Oh, huge misconception, right? From so many patients. So I love that you stated it, and let's state it again. Hysterectomy only means removal of the uterus with or without the cervix. If it's a total hysterectomy, that means they removed the cervix. If it's a supracervical hysterectomy, that means they left the cervix in your pelvis. And it has nothing to do with the ovaries or the tubes. And most people really misconstrue that. And the terminology that you and I hear a lot, right? Even from other doctors, is partial hysterectomy.
Oh my God, it makes me crazy. Do you know, I don't know if you know, but I have a book out. My first book I ever wrote was The Essential Guide to Hysterectomy, which is in its second edition. And I really should do an update because it's a good book. But yeah. I spent an entire chapter just explaining the nomenclature that partial hysterectomy means part of the uterus. It has nothing to do with the tubes or the ovaries.
And the truth is this, partial hysterectomy, I actually say, doesn't even exist as true medical vernacular. Because if someone says to us partial hysterectomy, we would naturally think, oh, part of your uterus, meaning a supracervical hysterectomy.
Correct.
But we would never use that terminology.
We're leaving the cervix there, just to be
clear. Right. Leaving the cervix. But we would never use partial hysterectomy as that vernacular because the average patient, when they tell us they had a partial hysterectomy, means my whole uterus was removed, but they left my ovaries behind.
Right.
That's still a total hysterectomy because it's separate to remove your uterus.
And when a woman says, I've had a total hysterectomy, what she means is she's had removal of the tubes and the ovaries. What we mean is that there's been removal of the total uterus, including the cervix. So the language is very problematic. And I cannot tell you how many times women say, I've had a hysterectomy, and I'll say, well, what was removed? And they honestly don't know.
They don't know.
Then I get the records, and it turns out that, in fact, they do have a remaining ovary, or someone left their tubes. And all of these things are really important. And aside from the issue of can they develop a cancer down the road and that they need to be monitored, I cannot tell you how many women have a removal of a uterus, have a hysterectomy when they're 40, their ovaries are still there, and yet no one is monitoring them for menopausal issues because it's this idea of, well, you had a whole hysterectomy. You don't need that. When in fact, they will generally go through menopause around the same time as if they hadn't had the hysterectomy.
Right. And again, this goes back to lack of education. Recently, I talked about the fact that a very educated husband whose wife was pregnant said to me, we were talking about removing her tubes at the time of her C-section. And he said, Doc, do you know what's crazy? You could remove someone's tubes and they'll still get their period. And I said, oh, well, I mean, You know, what's interesting is it's actually not crazy at all if you know your anatomy. And I meant it in a very nice way that
I'm
Aaron
sure
and
you
he and I
said
have a
it
good
very
relationship.
nicely.
Right. And I said, it's not crazy at all. What's actually crazy is that you, as an educated man, and your wife is an educated woman, and it's not your fault, but that you don't realize that it's actually completely normal to still get your period when we remove your tubes because the tubes have nothing to do with your period. And so again, it's lack of education that's really hurting and harming us because it's the lack of education that leads us to not know our signs and symptoms or even realize why we should continue to see a doctor. And the medical community feeds into this lack of education because we don't have the time to educate you and our governing bodies are blowing us off, right? They are basically telling us, you don't need to see the gynecologist, you know.
Yeah, I once did a survey of men and women post hysterectomy when I was writing the book. I did a survey. It was over 2,000 people, and I asked the women, "Do you know what was removed?" And then I listed all the parts, check off what was removed. Most of them did not, but the ones that really failed that test was their male partners. You know, your
Oh.
female partner had a hysterectomy. Do you know what was removed? And a huge number of them thought that she'd had her vagina removed and that could no longer have sex again. So
Yeah.
we have a lot of education to do. All right. So we've established that even if you've had removal of the uterus, you need an exam. Even if you've had removal of your tubes and your ovaries, you still need someone to do a careful evaluation of your vulva, your vagina, and other pelvic structures. But I want to get to the last topic, and we talked a little bit about the idea of sexual concerns of women who either with a long-term partner that develop as they get older, or what is it, like a third of women over the age of 50 are now single, something like that, and very often they're out
Right.
there with new partners.
Yes.
So a new report just came out from the CDC looking at rates of sexually transmitted infections, and the age group that has the highest increase in those rates are women over the
Over.
age of 55, specifically
Yep.
women. And so, and the specific things, and there's an increase across the board, but it was particularly gonorrhea, chlamydia, and syphilis.
Syphilis.
You know, we think that syphilis is, you know, Christopher Columbus, you know, historic interest
Right.
only. And in fact, syphilis is alive and well. And when we look at the reasons for this, number one, of course, is that, you know, people aren't using condoms. They think that,
Yeah.
okay, well, don't worry about getting pregnant. And you got a
Right.
guy that he can't maintain an erection with a condom, and he puts the condom on and the party's over, and you think he's a nice guy. And then, you know, so we'll just skip it. And I always say it's the nice guys you have to worry about because they're the ones that have had a lot of partners in their life. It's the
Right.
not nice guys that, you know, are
Right.
probably.
Right. No one wants to have sex with, yeah.
But also the thinning of the tissue,
Oh yeah, absolutely.
making women
Right.
more vulnerable. And interestingly, and we won't get on this because I can go on for hours and so could you, I'm sure, but women who use these high osmolality lubricants that actually break down the
The
tissue in the
condom.
vagina and make them more vulnerable to
Here.
get sexually transmitted infection.
Well, and again, getting back to education, it's because so many women are told, like, just use lube, just use lube. And
Or
so
just
the
use, you know, okay, let's just say it, just use KY lube when we
just
know
use K, right?
that KY is
Well,
a big problem.
and so if they, let's say they're smart enough to not use just a regular over-the-counter lube that might irritate them. So let's say they use coconut oil, which is an excellent lubricant, right? Inexpensive, very safe and healthy, but that can break apart a condom. More importantly, just using lube, you and I know, isn't going to actually make that tissue more elastic. So they're still going to have pain. They're still going to get irritation,
And they're still going to
increasing
get
irritant.
microscopic tears
And I
that
was going to
all
say,
those bugs can crawl right up.
Increased irritation, which is going to break down the skin, is going to increase their chance of herpes, HPV, gonorrhea, chlamydia, all of those things, and less pleasurable.
Right. Okay,
So,
but just to close the loop on this whole exam thing, one of the reasons we know that STI is increasing in women is that most sexually transmitted infections, gonorrhea, chlamydia, syphilis, in their early stages are asymptomatic. There are no symptoms. So if a woman is not having a gynecologic exam with a clinician who says, I would like, you know, would you like a screen for sexually transmitted infections? She's not going to get screened. So
Right.
not only are these women more vulnerable to infections because of the tissue issues, because of the lack of condom issues, because they're getting exposed because they're single, because they don't have an HPV vaccine, because they think they can't get one because they're over 45,
Right.
they're also not getting screened.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So actually, one other thing I want to touch upon with regard to that, especially with HPV, you heard that the FDA just approved of a self swab for in the office for HPV. So I think, so to me, what's exciting about this is not, oh, look, you can do everything on your own. You don't need a clinician. It is twofold. One, if we do self-swab in the office, then the benefit is those women who are coming into the office who would have had a pap smear, you still need to look at their vulva, but you can spend, you know, 1 to 3 more minutes educating them. So for our already, let's call them privileged women, whether they have Medicaid, whether they have private insurance, but those women who already have access to a gynecologist, if they do self-swab in the office, if it really pans out to be what we think, then we have more time to educate. And for all those women who honestly were never going to go into the office, either because they're in medical deserts, they have lack of access to care, they've got trauma issues where they don't want to come see a doctor, those women can potentially do self-swab at home if the technology shows it. That does not mean that these people should not still seek advice from a gynecologist who can develop a relationship with them to help teach them about everything else. So self-collection to me is wonderful, and I really believe there's a big, robust future for it because of how it can actually help the doctor and the patient collaborate better. So I really want people to know that, because I think a lot of people are going to hear about self-swab and think it's one more way for me to avoid seeing a doctor. It shouldn't. It should be one more way for you to collaborate with your doctor in a way that gives them and you both more information.
And to make the exam more comfortable, because a lot of women say, I will not go for a pap test.
Right, they avoid.
Or because it is so painful.
Yeah.
This is a way to screen for HPV, which is not just about cervical cancer. It's also about vulvar cancer, vaginal cancer, oropharyngeal cancers. And so anything we can do to break down those barriers and get more women screened is a good thing, mm-hmm. but it doesn't mean that we throw the rest of it out.
Exactly.
All right. So we've taken a lot of time with this, but I think it's all good information. Before we finish up, tell us about you a little bit, about where people can find you, the work that you do, because you do so many amazing things.
Thank you. Well, I mean, I think the biggest thing I want to do is to educate. I mean, I think that's why for 25 years, I've been in my office kind of crazy full time, one-on-one educating. And in the last year and a half, I've stepped away from being in the office as much. I don't ever want to not be with patients, meaning I always want part of my role to be as a direct to patient clinician, because I think that's how you and I really continue to learn. But I also want to amplify my voice, because I do think that people deserve to have this knowledge. And it's impossible to put the burden on doctors. Doctors not only don't always have the education, it's not their fault, but as you and I've said millions of times, we're not educated on menopause on our own in residency. But even those who are educated, doctors don't have the time. And something that I'm seeing increasingly among doctors is this angry rhetoric about how dismissive doctors are to their patients. And this is a doctors complaining about it. Yes, there are doctors who are dismissive. Yes, there are doctors who still practice very patriarchal medicine. But the truth is, a lot of us are out there trying and still taking insurance. And so that means we don't have as much time to spend. So to kind of malign all the doctors who are taking insurance by a lot of the doctors who aren't taking insurance is also unfair and just fractures us. We need doctors who don't take insurance. We need doctors who do take insurance. We need nurse practitioners and PAs. We need everyone to be able to amplify the education in ways that are going to help the doctors and the patients. And so one of the biggest things I like to do outside of my office is educate through Instagram. So you can find me on Dr. Shiva G on Instagram. And then I have our online platform called Tribe Called V, which we are actively growing and hopefully rebranding soon with a new name and new website with more information about all of the parts of your OBGYN health, from puberty and pregnancy and perimenopause and all of the issues that women have, both of which are normal and pathologic, because the more women learn about it, the better their relationship can be with their doctor. And then they can actually get healed much easier.
And I will put all of those links in the program notes so that people can find you. But I think also, and I've thought about doing an episode on this, and I haven't, and is how to get the most out of your 20 minutes in the doctor's office. But very clearly, one of the things is to educate yourself in advance, because in a perfect world, your doctor would sit down and talk with you for an hour and a half. But when I wrote my hysterectomy book, the reason I wrote it is I realized that my pre-op consultation was over an hour long.
Right.
And then I started requiring women who were coming in for a hysterectomy consult to read my book first. Yeah. And what I found is that it completely changed the dialogue, because I didn't have to sit there and explain that this is what a hysterectomy is. This is what includes, you know, the cervix.
Yes.
They already knew, so that we could then sit and spend some time talking about, do you want to remove your ovaries or not? What are the pros and cons? And you save so much time by having someone educated in advance.
Right. I think I love that.
We're preaching to the choir here, because people listening to this podcast are people who are trying to educate themselves and trying to learn more. Yeah. But the point is that this is going to go a long way to making your dialogue with your clinician that much better when you finally make it there, as long as you have a clinician.
As long as you have a good doctor. Well, and I always say, like, I want to expand my platform, not just because I love to do it and not just for the patients. I actually want to do it for the doctors too, because I feel like I want to be really clear where I think we can do better in the medical community, but I also want to defend us as a medical community, because again, we don't have time, especially if we take insurance. So I know that the patients who have taken our class, who see my practice, go into their pregnancies, for example, so much more educated, and they're calmer. And then
just stop you there, because when someone gets pregnant, it is automatic that they sign up for prenatal classes. They read all these books.
Well, not really. More so than menopause, for sure, but not really.
But we don't see the
Google a lot of it.
World. Yeah. So yeah,
but we don't see the menopause world. You're right, or any other aspect. I mean, it's pervasive in women's health. There's not enough. Yeah. All right.
Thank you so much. This has been great. I wish we had even more time, but I'll just have you back again.
I'll come back again at another time. Yeah.
Thank you. Okay, so Dr. Gofraini and I agree that it's time to stop treating your female genitalia like some kind of no-fly zone that's only examined if someone has excruciating pain, a zoo-like odor, or bleeding requiring a change of pad every 10 minutes. No one likes going to the gynie. I don't take this personally. And most women are thrilled when they're told that after 50, it's no longer necessary. But your annual gynecologic exam is not only an opportunity to discuss below-the-belt issues with an expert, but your opportunity to be reassured that everything is normal. I'm Dr. Lauren Stryker, and thank you for joining me. You will find lots more information in my Inside Information books, available on Amazon.com. And follow Francie as she navigates her way through vaginal dryness, hot flashes, and pretty much every menopausal symptom you can think of.
See the light, now I'm sleeping through the night.